Welcome, everybody. Special edition of the show. We've been doing a lot of these special editions here. We did the debate commentary. You could sync it up. Listen to me make fun of people, mostly Carly Fiorina. I feel bad. I was making fun of Carly Moore. But, I mean, come on. All right, never. So here's the deal. I was hoping to do a little 15-minute interview with my buddy, Dave Leventhal. He works for the Center for Public Integrity, not Public Inquiry, as I screw up at the beginning of the interview that you will hear. However, we got into such a great conversation that the whole darn thing wound up going 50 minutes instead of 15. I'm still probably going to cut up a little bit that I'm going to put into the podcast. So if this whole big honking interview is not your thing, I'll have the most interesting bits of it in the Politics, Politics, Politics podcast. That will happen on Friday. However, I figured I would give y'all the whole hog here now. So check it out. Dave Leventhal of the Center for Public Integrity. Formerly of the Dallas Morning News and Politico, you are now at the Center for Public Inquiry, correct?
Center for Public Integrity, although Integrity. You know, people botch the name all the time, so nothing new.
So Center for Public Integrity. Dave Leventhal joins us now. Dave, you have a tremendous history in tracking campaign money. That's where you've had your expertise. Your most recent article is about Charles Koch's giving to various universities. Let's go ahead and start there because it's probably got the biggest news peg. Describe what your article is about and some of the reaction to it.
Ultimately, what we sought to do is look at the biggest bold name political donors in the United States operating right now, conservatives, liberals, Republicans, Democrats, and specifically hone in on the private charitable foundations that they operate. Oftentimes, these are very prominent but under the radar vehicles through which these very, very wealthy individuals can do lots of things. They can make donations, for example, to fight cancer or to try to stave off poverty. Many, many, many different applications to this money. So, too, what is notable is that many of them be used and are used for other purposes. And one of the most notable purposes is funding for higher education. So you may be sitting in a classroom in New York or California or Nebraska or anywhere in between, and quite literally your class is being funded by a major political donor who has an ideology to speak of, who oftentimes is going to be very active in the political sphere. And what we did find with the Charles Koch Foundation and various private foundations that are associated with the Koch brothers is that they have been the top, in fact, at the top of charitable foundations that are active in this sphere. Bottom line, in 2013, the most recent year that we have returns available to analyze, it was just short of $20 million in terms of the money that was coming from Koch-related foundations to colleges and universities all across America, about 210 different colleges and universities received Koch funding, and that was across about 46 states in the District of Columbia. So really what ultimately we were able to show is that not only is the support from the Koch brothers to colleges and universities growing at a very aggressive rate, but it's almost all across the country right now and very much in line and tied to the political agenda, whether you like it or whether you don't like it. It's still very much tied to the Koch brothers' political agenda to advocate and evangelize a free market economic way of doing business in the United States, deregulatory philosophy that is very popular among some camps, and also very controversial among others.
So I had this thought in reading your article, and again, everybody really, really needs to read it, and I would very much appreciate if I would evangelize the idea of reading it with as much of an open mind as possible. Because I have this idea for the article. You have a splash page, and you can just ask people who the last person they voted for president was, and if it was Mitt Romney, then you can just find and replace all of Charles and Coke with Santa and Claus. And if it was Barack Obama, then you can replace all of Charles and Coke with Hitler Frankenstein. Because it seems like whenever you get into a conversation about the Koch brothers, and this is so much tied to the fact that the emotion of the political climate gets so enraged that there really is only two very bizarre polar opposite ways to look at what is, I think, fairly obviously a very complicated and interesting figure, whether or not you agree with him, in the American political landscape.
Well, we talked at length with colleges and universities that receive funding from Koch-related foundations. We talked to the Koch Foundation itself and people who are intimates of the Koch brothers or their operations. And they make a very important point, which is, look, we believe of this type of course of study, this philosophy writ large, is a really good thing. We're not going to apologize for it. We're not going to say anything but that we really think that this is something that is good for students, that gives students another option, another perspective in the campus sort of writ large. And as a result, it's something that is a worthy course of study, a legitimate course of study. And so what if we're giving money to colleges and universities to go forth and do this type of stuff? Now, the other side to that is,
well, I think they would also say that it's underrepresented, yeah. Right? That
and very underrepresented in their opinion. And,
yeah.
You know, look, you don't need to do a strict analysis to know that colleges and universities unbalance have for ages leaned a bit leftward. And of course, there are exceptions to that rule or any rule, but they very much feel like this is a countervailing force that needs to be there. And if it wasn't there, then, the colleges and universities would be tilting leftward even more than they are right now.
Yeah.
So that's all fine and good. The story, though, focuses very prominently, though, on what has become, and this is largely from a recording that we were able to obtain in the course of reporting this story, of a secret meeting with big-time donors of the Koch brothers' political operation and otherwise, where top Koch officials basically laid out their strategy for funding education. And quote one of the officials, they said, what we're trying to do is, quote, build a talent pipeline from the classroom to the halls of political power. So it was clear from that and many other things that were said and various documents that were obtained and are cited in the story that the Koch foundations are trying to build a very intimate relationship with many colleges and universities across the country, and that they're, you know, not strictly doing this for educational purposes, although they do say that this is just strictly education. There's a political aspect to this by their own words. And as a result, that at least in some people's mind is called into question the efficacy of this all, called into question whether the Koch brothers are really all about education or if they're really just trying to kind of identify,
create a race of super soldiers so they can overrun the world.
The new X-Files series is coming up next year. We'll see if there's any Koch brother angle to all this. But in all seriousness, I mean, this is something that, especially for people who are on the left side of the coin, Democrats who have just demonized the Koch brothers left and right in political context, say, well, look, this has proven the point that these guys care about one thing and one thing only, which is their own philosophy, which in the opinion of many folks on the left and many Democrats, all the way up to the leadership of the Democratic Party, they're like, well, the Kochs are anti-regulation, they're anti-environment, they're anti-this, they're anti-that, they're bad for the nation. That's where the Democrats and many liberals are coming from. So, you know, you talk about the gulf in between. Well, you either love the Kochs or you hate the Kochs, and there's not much in between. This information about how they're funding academia definitely does factor into that. And I can't imagine that the Koch brothers are going to be anything more than as polarizing a force as they've ever been in the 2016 election cycle, with the presidency at stake and an open seat and a two-term president leaving. It's just, you thought 2012 was crazy and 2014 during the midterms was crazy.
you know, wait about 2 or 3 months. It's going to get a lot hotter.
Oh, absolutely. So let's broaden it out just a little bit, because I've just in following this kind of noticed a trend, and for whatever reason, the right leaning, there seems to be more celebrity to the right leaning mega donors, that outside of George Soros, there's not quite a lot of curating for the big gigantic money power players on the left, in the way that Sheldon Adelson or the Kochs are kind of have become in their own way, although, you know, certainly mostly because of liberal leaning press, demagogued kind of infamous figures. But on the right, it seems like with both Sheldon Adelson and the Kochs, and part of what you reported on in that story, is the narrative is that these are people with a lot of money that want to change the world before they die, that there is this odd kind of mortality narrative to it. From somebody who's followed the industry, how much of this is this the rule, or are these just famous exceptions that we are now becoming more aware with?
Well, they're exceptions by virtue of the fact that there aren't too many politically active billionaires of the type that we're talking about right here. There may seem like a lot of them, but truly there are only a handful who are active in the way that the Kochs and Soros and Adelson and guys like that are. That all being said, sure, it's true. They're getting older. They're not going to live forever. They would very much, regardless of what their perspective is on politics, like to see as much action happen in their lifetime, their natural lifetime, as possible. I suppose that's only human nature, whether you have two nickels to rub together or $30 billion to throw around. So as a result, I had a great interview with Brian Doherty. He's a senior editor at Reason Magazine, who spoke very much to this point. He's interviewed both Koch brothers for a book that he wrote. He's somebody who is very much a libertarian leaning thinker and a great writer. I would encourage anyone to read his work. Fascinating stuff. But he made the point that, hey, you know, their horizon is nearing, and this is something that is probably for them very much at the forefront of what they're trying to do right now. They're trying to, yes, on one hand, play the long game and hope that they're going to be able to affect the way that people think in the United States 30, 40, 50, 100 years down the line. But also, too, they want to make their mark made in the here and now, because they'd like to see as much of that happen as possible while they can still see it.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about 2016, because this seems to be a very odd year for, from my perspective, and just as somebody who follows a lot of this, specifically when it comes to money. You have a roller disco full of Republican nominees vying for the right to run against Hillary Clinton, but there seems to be, at least by some of the press, maybe less money in it this year at this stage in the game, because Sheldon Adelson feels regret that he backed Santorum and Gingrich so hard against Romney, and he feels like he damaged the potential for a Republican president. From your perspective, as somebody who follows this, is that the case, or is that overblown?
Well, now I'm going to have to go and first bleach the image of Chris Christie on rainbow laced roller skates out of my brain. But after I do that,
imagine Jindal with a headband, Olivia Newton-John kind of outfit, a spangly outfit.
No, I more see that on Bernie Sanders, but that being the case, look, this is an entirely new, bizarre, nobody could have dreamt it up scenario here in 2016 relative to where we were at even last election cycle. Certainly 8 years ago, when Barack Obama was running against John McCain, or Hillary Clinton was running against Barack Obama, whatever stage you want, the deal is this, that if you are a legitimate presidential candidate, you're basically one of two things right now. You're a candidate who has an incredible amount of support from what effectively is a parallel campaign operation, typically driven by a super PAC, one of these political organizations that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money They're not by law supposed to be able to coordinate directly with a campaign committee. So, for example, you can't sit down at the boardroom table and plot out the course of your ad strategy or tell somebody in a campaign, if you're leading a super PAC, how to run their operation or deploy resources. That would be something that would be prohibited. But what we're finding here in 2016 is that many of these groups, and I think Jeb Bush is a great example, Hillary Clinton would be another great example, you have these candidates and these super PACs are supporting the candidates that are about as closely tied as you can get without breaking the law. So Jeb Bush, his super PAC, it's called Right to Rise USA. He himself was the animating force behind the super PAC prior to him becoming an official candidate and having to play by the rules that decide and arbiter or the arbiter of a candidate committee coordinating with a super PAC. Now, meanwhile, he becomes a candidate, and the super PAC is run by who? Well, people who have worked with Jeb Bush for a long, long, long time and are about as close to Jeb Bush as you can get. They're going to be able to be the second best thing to Jeb Bush himself running the super PAC, and as a result can operate, again, sort of as that parallel campaign committee. Same thing with Hillary Clinton. She has a whole bunch of her operatives and supporters and whatnot running super PACs, and not just one, but a couple that are supporting her candidacy. So this is the way it is. Now, we said all of that, and I said, well, there's another side to this, and the other side is Donald Trump and Ben Carson and Bernie Sanders. And they're sort of the anti-super PAC candidates. In a way, Donald Trump is his own super PAC. He's a billionaire. He can raise as much money as he wants to out of his own pocket. And then you have Bernie Sanders and Ben Carson, who are interesting in the sense that their bulk of support that they're getting is not coming from super PACs or big dollar donors necessarily. It's coming from a lot of excitement among people who are giving, $20 or $50 or $100. And the two candidates are in their own way, cobbling all that together and running as successful a campaign as almost anyone as a result of being able to kind of run against the big money in politics machine that many of the other candidates have spooled up in a major way right now.
Have you noticed? I was watching the last Republican debate. It was almost jarring to hear so much of like the 1% and the big business fat cats kind of rhetoric from a GOP primary stage. Like it just seems like we have turned a corner in favor of the populist sentiment, even on the conservative side.
Well, if you heard the last debate or any of the three Republican debates, it's pretty clear that you've got several different factions up there. And one thing you do have is kind of what you described. I would say, generally speaking, it might be the more business-oriented, mainstream Republican, use whatever euphemism you want to describe what the Jeb Bushes, and maybe throw Marco Rubio in there.
Yeah.
And,
the establishment candidates.
The more establishment standard bearer types. And then you have the kind of Tea Party wing. You have the Ted Cruzes of the world, at least led by him, who are really going to the right of where that would be and are critical of the Bushes and the Rubios of the world and are taking a much more, hard right-leaning approach, but also to a more evangelical approach in a way, too. There's a religious element to it.
Yeah.
And you'll find that a lot in what Mike Huckabee may have to say about issues and a couple of others. And then finally, you have sort of the, I am not A, I am not B, I am decidedly option C candidates. And Ben Carson and Donald Trump, the consummate political outsiders who will wear that brand with pride wherever they go. Ben Carson sending out fundraising emails hither and yon with the subject line, "I am not a politician." Stuff that effectively is trying to distance themselves from the field, regardless of whether they're Tea Party or mainstream. It's like we are a third option within the Republican Party. And that, Justin, has been the most attractive thing of all for Republican primary goers to hear, at least at this point. Now, we could have this conversation in 3 more months and be talking in an entirely different way because, well, the primary and caucus season will then be upon us and voters' minds may change. But here we are right now, and it's striking because we really haven't seen this in recent memory in the way that we have right now, where true outsiders, at least in a political sense, are doing as well for such a sustained period. We saw it a little bit in 2012. You know, Herman Cain had his moment in the sun and all that, but ultimately that came and it went, and it came and went very quickly. Not this time. This is just a bizarro political election at this stage in the game. And the same can be true on the Democratic side, too, in the sense that, sure, Bernie Sanders has been in the U.S. Senate for a long time. He's a career politician by any measure, but he's also somebody who is an avowed Democratic socialist. And that's about as outsidery as you can get. Republican Party, Democratic Party. I mean, just talking about U.S. politics, it's antithetical to the way that our economics run in this country. So that's pretty striking, too, that he's providing such a strong challenge to Hillary Clinton, who, you know, even months ago, everyone said, well, she's got the nomination locked up, done. Doesn't matter who runs against her, even Joe Biden. Yeah. Not going to beat her.
So speaking of bizarro, up is down, left is right, things with this particular election. Has there ever been a candidate for president who has made money running? And does Donald Trump have a shot to be the first?
Well, you look at his campaign finance reports, and it's remarkable. Now there are some technical aspects of this that I won't bore you with, but look, he is paying himself for certain campaign services. You have a couple things going on here, even though Donald Trump says I'm a billionaire, I'm providing the money for my campaign. Fact is, he hasn't spent much money at all relative to some of the other candidates on his campaign, in part because he's Donald Trump and he's getting as much earned media as perhaps most of the rest of the Republican field combined together. And so, all right, he's not pouring a lot of money into it yet he is raising some degree of money from people, mainly people who are giving that to Donald Trump's campaign. Donald Trump, in turn, is using a good deal of the money that he's raised to pay for various services, companies that Donald Trump owns. So it's a very curious circle here. It's like a company town mentality for running a political operation. The company, it runs the mine and then it runs the store and it writes a paycheck to the people who work in the mine, and people go to the company store and buy products at the, the mine companies. And it's this nice virtuous circle for the company. Now, Donald Trump, he's not going to get rich off his campaign. And by the end, he's going to have to spend a lot more money probably than he is now. But it is kind of a curiosity, if nothing else, that he has this infrastructure that he has to provide him air charter services and even do merchandising and all the various other things that his campaign has relied on, well, at this point, Donald Trump companies to do.
You know, I guess there's just a vision in my head that I can't get out, and that is, Donald Trump dropping out earlier than people think if his numbers aren't great, crowing about how he was the first person to ever make money running for president, and then if the Republican is elected, basically taking credit for the fact that the GOP is back in the White House. There's just something about it that, whenever anybody was like, oh, will he run independent? I'm like, I don't know. I don't feel like that makes the most business sense for Donald Trump, which, however you might define his grand report card for being a businessman, he certainly considers himself that, and that seems far more likely than him going up at odds and being a Ross Perot-like pariah amongst conservative voters.
Well, even the very notion of him making money off his own campaign would be the most Trumpian thing that you could ever think
right?
of. It makes me think of when he, you know, he bought Monday Night Raw from Vince McMahon and then tried to sell it back to him for twice what he bought it for. I mean, it's shtick, sure, on one end, but also, too, now it's very much reality. And, you know, nobody is quite a master of the capitalist game than Donald Trump.
Oh, listen, if
he's
he
been
if
that
he...
guy for our entire lifetimes. I mean, think back to your earliest memories of, you know, associating the notion of a rich dude with anyone. And, you know, when we were in diapers, we were thinking about Donald Trump. So it's amazing his longevity.
I mean, if you look at, yeah, I mean, the villain in, you know, and this is kind of came up because the Back to the Future stuff last week or 2 weeks ago, you know, the idea that, you know, that Biff was based on Donald Trump and stuff like that. It's like, no, this guy has been running this campaign for as long as we've been alive. Like, this has all been in service to right now. And whoever, you know, I think by you know, most metrics, few people think that he has the ability to win the nomination. Although, I mean, listen, this has been a crazy enough primary season up till now. Nothing would shock anybody. But you know that whoever he endorses, they're still going to be selling Make America Great Again, you know, hats and T-shirts outside.
And say what you want about Donald Trump. And you can find the biggest Donald Trump hater out there. But even that person is going to have to acknowledge that what Donald Trump talks about and his style and his persona and the show that he puts on, that in and of itself is just something that for some corners of the electorate is always going to be an incredibly attractive thing. And people like the notion of a winner. People like the notion of somebody who is going to say, well, look, I'm just going to kick everyone else's ass. I'm going to do a better job, and it's going to be bigger, and it's going to be bolder, and it's going to be better. And you know, how do you get past that? So I think that's what the other candidates have been struggling with, is that regardless of who Donald Trump is, and regardless of what he says, he's tapping into a sentiment out there where people have been struggling. People have seen leadership, whether it's Republican or Democrat, they have just simply not been thrilled with. And as opposed to saying, well, let's find somebody in the party that I like who's just a little bit better, but pretty much reading from the same playbook. Let's just find somebody who's totally, completely different. So in a way, you know, hearkening back to the Ross Perot days, that was sort of a thing back in the early 90s where people were saying, well, we want a third option here. We want an independent option. Donald Trump is doing it obviously a little bit differently in the sense that he is running as a Republican, but still I think the fundamental underlying notion is similar. There are a lot of people who are just yearning for a candidate who is cutting through it all and not playing politics the same way. And whether that is sustainable all throughout the primary election into the general very much remains to be seen, but man, it is sure something that is strong and is real and is connecting people to the political process in a way that we haven't seen for a while, at least not since Barack Obama was able to tap into a different kind of sentiment, but still one that was very energetic back 8 years ago.
And even then, you know, the retail interest in the debates this early in the process, which was previously only watched by total nerds like me and you, like, is just staggering. Like, the idea that they are drawing, you know, even at CNBC's number, which was off what the previous two were for the Republican debates, is just insane. Like, 15 million people to watch CNBC for the third Republican primary debate is just a freak show.
Well, you know, if you're told, well, hey, in 2 hours, that building down the street, they're going to implode it. or, you know, somebody's just going to start this house on fire. Well, you know, it's kind of hard to just say, I got to do laundry. I got to go to the gym. I got to do something else. I'm just going to go, you know, watch Monday Night Football. You're going to watch it. And I think that the Donald Trump factor certainly plays into that to a strong degree. But you know, also too, we've got other candidates on the stage who are attractive to people in their own ways. And, you know, not to extend the wrestling metaphor too terribly much here, but when you've got the ultimate like Survivor Series thing going on, mm-hmm. Battle Royale, where you don't have two or three or five candidates up on stage, but you got 10 of them and they're all going to go after each other. And you know that there's going to be action. That's something that's very, very compelling. And heck, one of these guys is going to be the nominee for the Republican Party. So you better tune in because everyone else is going to be doing so.
All right. So from a money perspective and you follow, you know, all the stuff that needs to be reported federally in terms of money that comes in, there's a lot of candidates on the Republican side. There can't be that many candidates for much longer. You've already seen high profile names drop out fairly early compared to where people thought they would be. Who is money wise in the most trouble in the Republican field?
So there are candidates who have less money on hand than Rand Paul, but if I'm Rand Paul, I'm probably feeling pretty lousy about my presidential life right now in the sense that he has vastly underperformed when it comes to fundraising. He doesn't really have that much going for him in the way of a strong, moneyed super PAC that can prop him up in areas where he may be weak, such as the ability to go up on television or whatnot, which is one of the primary ways a super PAC can be helpful to a candidate committee. His stock is really going down, and he just doesn't have much cash at all in his own campaign coffer to hire staffers and get good people and have a presence in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, and Nevada, all these early states. So he's one of the what you, I guess, would consider top tier or close to top tier candidates from several months ago who's just in a really, really tough position right now. And it's hard to see how he gets out of that, you know, in the next couple of months. Jeb Bush, he has, as of last report back at the end of September, about $10 million cash on hand. But that too is, seems like a lot of money, but disastrous compared to what a lot of people thought he was going to have. And he's in the midst right now of quote unquote rebooting his campaign, whatever that means. And he's somebody who's just struggling mightily, even though his super PAC that's supporting him, that we talked about a moment ago, that he was the creative force behind in the first place. They're raising more money than anyone, but they're also spending it and it's not working. So he's got some fundamental underlying issues about his campaign and his candidacy that he's going to have to come to grips with very, very soon, or else he could be somebody who could be in a very, very serious world of hurt.
I want to get to Jeb Bush in more detail in a second, but let me just ask you real quick about all the candidates that are kind of at the kids' table in the 5 o'clock, the happy hour debates, the Lindsey Grahams and the Jindals and the Pataki's of the world, Santorum. At what point, I mean, like, are they just kind of running a budget campaign and therefore they'll be around for longer, just kind of hoping for money to fall? Or are they in just as much trouble as some of the, you know, Rand Pauls and Jeb Bushes, where expectations are kind of weighing them down just as much as anything?
In a way, they're liberated by the fact that they don't have any money at all. They can stay in the race. They can still show up at debates. They're still going to get called by the networks or the cable stations or radio shows to go and talk. So if you're George Pataki or you're Bobby Jindal, Lindsey Graham may be a bit of a different case, but Jim Gilmore or, you know, any of the other guys who have not made it onto the main stage at the debates, who people forget half the time are even in the race, throw Rick Santorum on that list too. Well, there's the opposite question is, well, why should they even get out? There might be other guys who are doing better in the polls, who have more money, but the expectations are way higher. They may very well drop out. That happened to Scott Walker. That happened to Rick Perry. It may happen to Rand Paul or a couple of others by the time February rolls around and we have our first real bona fide contests that have to be waged. And, you know, two things. They're hoping for sort of what happened with Rick Santorum in 2000 2012 and what happened with Newt Gingrich in 2012, which is that they festered at the bottom of the polls and just kind of hung there and clung on to the race, so not seeming to go anywhere. And then they just had this almost inexplicable bounce where things just kind of began to fall their way. And they had for a while a credible campaign running against Mitt Romney because nobody was thrilled with Mitt Romney. So it seems like some of them are hoping that Donald Trump might flame out or that Jeb Bush may blow up or various other things will happen that will give them an opportunity to jump up. And Lindsey Graham is really hoping that that's going to happen. He'll get on the main stage, he'll have a moment, and he'll be in that top tier. And the other thing, too, is, well, if you're running for president and you're still getting press, even if you don't have any money, it could help you personally. Look at Mike Huckabee. He ran in 2008. He did win some states, but ultimately he never really had a chance of winning the Republican nomination against John McCain. And yet he parlayed that into a very successful career. He had a Fox News show. He was on the radio, somebody who had a great measure of popularity among a certain camp for a solid 8 years and is waging another presidential campaign right now. So there, bottom line, there are benefits to it, some intangible, others not, where even if you're not a Marco Rubio or a Donald Trump or a Ben Carson, why not stay in the game?
So then why is it different on the other side? And we saw Lincoln Chafee and Jim Webb drop out after poor debate performances. They were at least next to the candidate. It would make sense that everything you've just said about Bobby Jindal and George Pataki should be true for them, except for my popular theory that they walked into their darkened living room and found Hillary Clinton in the shadows, slowly cracking her knuckles until they quit the race.
Well, the fact of the matter is that they were barely even running a race at all. And at least with Bobby Jindal and some of the other folks on the Republican side who are at the bottom of the pool here, it's even worse for the couple that you mentioned on the Democratic side. They just simply weren't conducting events. They were barely showing up anywhere. It was almost as if they were running this ghost campaign where they were candidates in name only. And one is no longer a candidate. Jim Webb is weighing whether to run as an independent. But you had to struggle to find what they were doing because there was just so little of them doing anything.
Is there any chance that there, you know, you'll have, I mean, Lawrence Lessig is running, it seems to have put more effort into his campaign than Jim Webb or Lincoln Chafee did before they showed up on the stage. Is there any chance that he gets any of that face time, or is the DNC very much committed to whittling that number down as opposed to adding it?
Well, the number's been whittled down as it is. So Lessig is running a campaign. He's very much running a campaign, and he's conducting events, and he's an outspoken guy, and he has really a one-issue campaign for all intents and purposes, which is about money and politics and how, in his opinion, it has corrupted the process, and it's the process that needs to change, even more than the people. And that's been his thing. It's long been his thing prior to him ever deciding that he was going to run for president. You may recall that during the midterms, he had a super PAC, which still does exist under different leadership, that was going to go out and support candidates and give money to candidates that he had a very reformist agenda that cleaved to what Larry Lessig was evangelizing. So that's his deal over there. Martin O'Malley, he hasn't been able to catch fire really in any way, but he too is running a real campaign. He has staff. He goes to events. He conducts events. He shows up on shows, and it's just a matter of him.
Songs with his guitar, and
and he plays songs, and he's a Taylor Swift fan, and we now know, and all this
takes
kind of good
requests,
stuff. Martin
O'Malley, in so many ways, feels like the guy who would just start playing guitar at a party, whether or not people wanted to or not. Like, he's just gonna see, like, just let him go. Let him play the one song he knows.
You got him on guitar. Mike Huckabee can play the bass pretty well. We could have like a serious serious house ban that we could have among presidential candidates, I think, if you polled everyone on what they can play. But I don't think we'll be seeing them anytime soon. Anyway, with Martin O'Malley, he's another guy who thinks that he's just going to be able to wait long enough where something's going to happen with Hillary Clinton, or he's going to have a moment at a debate where he really, really shines and is going to get a second look from Democratic voters. It's a real long, 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 long shot right now. But again, you know, you have a 5% chance of something happening and cutting your way if you stay in, and you have a 0% chance if you drop out now.
All right. Last question, because this is something that I know that you enjoy from following your Twitter account. What is your Twitter account again, so everybody can follow you?
Sure, it's at Dave Leventhal, and that's Levinthal.
Campaign fundraising emails. They are just this bizarre, imperfected witchcraft that might be the only thing that you know, liberals can agree to criticize Barack Obama about, you know, and nobody seems to have gotten right. What is the most bizarre either single email or email strategy or trend that you have seen so far this season?
I've got the one to say my favorite one among the volumes of absolutely truly bizarre ones I've gotten would be difficult. I'd have to go into my archives. But look, if you are suddenly inspired to donate to a politician or a political campaign because of particularly some of the worst fundraising emails out there from Democrats or Republicans, then you may want to have an intervention with yourself. Some of them are out and out lies, which may not shock anyone. But at the same time, too, it many of them pander to the lowest of the low of the low common denominator. I guess the one that was my favorite from this past week was Hillary Clinton. I heard a speech and whatnot that I was listening to where, man, I mean, she really sounded very convincing when it came to supporting people who were going through tough economic times or very solidly middle class or hoping to get up into the middle class from their lot of where they are right now, and talking about everyday Americans and talking about families and I mean about as apple pie and, you know, mother's milk because you can possibly get. And then comes a fundraising email from Christina Aguilera and about how you can go to Beverly Hills at her house where she's going to be performing for Hillary Clinton right there at this exclusive Tony event. And we want you to come there too. So, you know, I mean, some of it, and I'm picking on Hillary Clinton here. This is happening everywhere. Make no mistake.
Oh, no.
Some of it is just, it's just so pandering and unseemly that it makes you laugh.
And that's I brought up Obama before it. Because he was kind of famously, you know, when you put all of his emails together, it seemed like a desperate ex-boyfriend who was just like, you know, very much in need to get in touch with you. And it was just a lot of like, remember us and I need you and please answer my emails. It was just a lot of those subject lines. But again, I think the favorite that I think I saw on your Twitter was just now the new trend of like the fake out, I'm quitting the race email that like, you know, like, this is about the end. And then you open it up and it's like, if you don't give me $5 right now.
Well, it's it fundraising emails you have evolved or better said devolved from what were, you know, just regular standard kind of marketing emails that you would get from anyone, some of which were actually quite informative and talked about issues and whatnot. Now to just sort of this very cynical game of trying to just get people to open up the email
just click spam.
With what is effectively a blatant lie. And you know, it's getting to the point of absurdity at this point. And it makes for very, very good Twitter fodder, if nothing else.
All right. I do want to get to my Jeb Bush question and then I'll let you go. Let's say he continues to stagnate and does not create any further interest in his campaign. Based on the money that he has now, if he is just going to ghost on whatever money and everything he tries fails, how long is Jeb Bush in this race?
He, a lot of different factors could play into this, but just from a strictly cash standpoint, here's one scenario that's plausible. He could really begin to flame out from his own campaign, where he's not bringing in money and is going to have to basically retrench even beyond what he's done right now with paying staff. He's cut salaries, mind you, already, to scale back things in a way that you may have seen with John McCain in 2007, prior to him winning the nomination, where mm-hmm. he kind of did an all-in strategy for New Hampshire. Jeb could go that route, potentially, and still be buoyed by the tens and tens of millions of dollars that he's raised through the super PAC that's supporting him, which, again, can take unlimited donations compared to his own campaign, which is only able to take very limited donations, $2,700 per election. So if you or me or anyone else in America wants to give Jeb Bush money, you can give him $2,700 for the primary. If you want to give his super PAC that's supporting him $10 million, you can go ahead and give $10 million. So that's a difference right there. So his super PAC potentially could keep him afloat up until those early contests, even if things go more south than they've gone right now, and they're going pretty far south, make no mistake about it. So that's one scenario. And the other scenario is he's able to right a ship and get the money going, and he'll be in a better place. But even in that kind of doomsday scenario, super PACs, Republican, Democrat, for whoever, give candidates a measure of security. It's not a be-all, end-all thing, and we saw that with Scott Walker, and we saw that with Rick Perry, where they had super PACs, they had a lot of money, but effectively their campaigns were just going nowhere, and they were dropping like stones, and they had to get out. Jeb Bush isn't there yet, but the concern among his supporters is he's getting there quickly, and he's going to have to turn things around very quickly in order for him to still be a legitimate candidate.
And the rise of Rubio is kind of his worst nightmare, right? I mean, just from a strategy point of view, you know, he Rubio is kind of the younger version without the experience of being a governor that plays into what would be Jeb Bush's strengths, including the idea of winning the Florida primary.
Yeah, and including winning the Florida primary, and that's a mid-March contest. And if Rubio wins the Florida primary and Jeb doesn't, I don't see really any scenario where Bush will be able to recover from that if the candidates are still both in the race at that point. So Bush is really, really having to reconvince a lot of Florida supporters in particular that he's the guy, he's still the guy, and that it's not time to hand the Florida political reins over to Marco Rubio in a presidential context at this juncture. So Bush is having to deal with stuff nationally. He's having to deal with stuff in Florida. He's having to deal with a very, very low poll numbers in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina. So he's got a lot to do. He's got a lot of work ahead of him. And it's a very surprising development for a lot of folks in the Republican Party who thought he was going to be the guy through and through from beginning to end.
He was supposed to be as airtight as Hillary, right? I mean, this seemed like a pencil it in Bush versus Clinton contest from the jump.
If not quite as pencil it in as Hillary, pretty close. Obviously, there's more competition on the Republican side than there is on the Democratic side, just given the sheer numbers over there. But really, when it comes down to it, nobody expected Trump. Nobody expected Trump to do what he's done. And Trump has thrown the whole Republican primary into disarray, glorious disarray, he would certainly argue, but mm-hmm. the disarray nonetheless, in the sense that the establishment has not just been able to grab this thing by the neck and run with it.
He's certainly unpredictable. You don't know whether or not he's carrying a gun. Just ask him. Dave Leventhal is a writer and reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Thank you so much. Follow him at Dave Leventhal. Any final thoughts here on the dawning of the 2016 presidential race?
Well, we have campaign finance numbers that come out at the end of this year. They actually come out in January. So. For a while yet, you know, oftentimes money tells the story. And even though we have this thing called the internet and the ability to file campaign finance disclosures instantaneously. The way that the system works, we're kind of going into this big black box period where we don't really know how much anyone is raising and where they're getting their money from right until we're on the doorstep of the New Hampshire primary and the Iowa caucuses. So kind of an interesting phenomenon where old school meets new school, and you know, old school's winning out when it comes to the disclosure of all this stuff, and that we don't get a real true comprehensive look for anyone between now and in a couple of months from now.
Thank you so much for joining me. Everybody go read Dave's new thing, our new piece on the funding by Charles Koch to universities across the country. Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Justin.
Politics, 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 politics.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.